The guy's arms had been blown off at the shoulder. Raphael got hold of him somehow, and we rushed back to the perimeter, yelling our names to prevent being knocked off by our own people. We put the first guy into Doc Benjamin's tiny hex tent foxhole surgery, and the good doctor went right to work, but it proved to be a losing battle. Just as one of the medics got back from the OP with the second casualty, Raphael shook his head. "No," he said. "I've lost this motherfucker. Pass me the other one." We put the second body down, but it was too late. He was already dead. "Shit," said Raphael. "Shit, shit, shit." My eyes stung. Raphael, unlike myself, was not prone to using profanity. He probably wouldn't have called a dead patient a motherfucker back home in Louisiana. On the other hand, in the airborne, the term motherfucker, unless spoken harshly, was among the highest terms of endearment. But back home in Louisiana, he wouldn't have been living like an animal, either, or trying to save lives by flashlight in a muddy hole in the dark of night. Johnny Howard took an M79 and, alone, started out into the darkness to see if he could find anything. He fired at some movement, but couldn't see the result. Though we didn't find a body in the morning, some bloodied gear on the ground nearby was evidence, at least, that Johnny had hit home. Meanwhile, I let the word go forth that at first light every leader was to take his men out to that OP to have a first-hand look at that cigarette and the blood of those two men in that foxhole. Furthermore, I said that anyone who smoked between 7 in the evening and 7 in the morning, on the line, in the base camp, even on R&R in Hong Kong, might as well get his ass out of the battalion, because if I caught him, he'd spend the rest of his tour with a split lip and 2 black eyes courtesy of my fists. Operations in the Tuy Hoa area continued. Task Force Hackworth was reestablished for 1 independent mission when Colonel Rogers wanted a little extra experience on the team, and with Abu Company, a platoon of Tigers and a little CP group, I eagerly moved out into the unknown. We infiltrated into our AO by stealth, moving out of the battalion's temporary firebase on foot and at night. Choppers would have gotten us there a hell of a lot faster, but they made enough noise to virtually guarantee there'd be nothing to get when we got there. Any enemy within 5 miles would say, "Yanks come, we run away," and be gone before we even sat down. The operation was 5 days in length. At the outset, I made a rule that for the duration, there'd be no resupply aircraft buzzing around dropping in hot food or ice cream or beer, and no comma with higher HQ either, except a daily report via Daryl's radio and 292 antenna. The kids weren't shook by the new ground rules at all. They sneaked through the forest like a silent pack of Daniel Boones, all of them so much into the spirit of things that even the wounded didn't bitch. They just hobbled along on their sprained ankles knowing the pain could be lived with, and there was something more important going on. "Look, man," I'd explained, "we're sneaking up here on the enemy, and we're not giving our position away. Sure, you've got a little scratch. You don't see any helicopters evacuating the NVA out, do you? What do? They stick with their outfit and walk and heal up. They're hardcore, but you're hardcore, too." Why the troops took so easily to the on-the-job training OJT guerrilla game was probably partly because it was different, partly because it was fun, and partly because they knew we really were right on the NVA's tail. Signs were everywhere. Recent camps, recently used trails, broken branches. Meanwhile, for the first time since I'd arrived in Vietnam, I was having my own opportunity to feel the deceptively quiet battlefield and the enemy's presence therein. I became convinced, for example, that when a U.S. unit was in the bush in an enemy AO, it was always followed by an enemy recon element, maybe just 2 or 3 men whose whole purpose was to watch, work out the mission, look for weaknesses, and then report back to their parent outfit. So one morning I had my CP group fill an empty case of sea rations with dirt for weight, restrap it with its original wire to make it look unopened, and then bury it with a live frag grenade underneath. We moved out, and not 20 minutes later after we'd left that night position, bam, I sent an element back and they found the booby trap had killed two VCs. This technique became standard practice. Until now, with good reason, the enemy had considered the wasteful Americans a principal supplier of ammo and raw materials for his own booby traps and mines. Having our units police up, bury, and booby trap everything the Viet Cong would otherwise have scrounged gave the enemy a much-deserved taste of his own medicine, and our troopers a hell of a lot of satisfaction. Another technique that evolved from this was to have an ambush element stay back in our vacated night positions. 50% of the time they drew blood. As my task force crept on, I could feel we were on the edge of a great fight. The adrenaline was pumping. With each more careful step, I knew we were getting closer. Then, after so many of my troops had braved their minor wounds without even a whimper, or at least one I heard, my own operations sergeant got sick. Sick, like he was going to die, according to the doc, who was the senior aid man and a top medic. Thanks to Raphael Benjamin, I thought I knew quite a bit about diagnostics and field medicine. I felt particularly savvy about hepatitis and gonorrhea. These, along with malaria, were the most common complaints voiced by the scores of battalion members who wandered through the doc's tent in the middle of the night while I tried to sleep on the other stretcher. For suspected hepatitis cases, Raphael always stuck his hand under the trooper's rib cage to see if his liver was hard. For gonorrhea, he'd just say, "Reel it out and let me have a look." And then if things looked drippy, he'd tell the guy to come back in the morning for a shot of penicillin. It seemed pretty straightforward, and I was sure a little of Doc Benjamin had to have rubbed off on me by now, so I got the operations sergeant to lie on the ground and, having ruled out clap from the outset, put my hand under his ribcage as I'd seen Raphael do a million times. Though I had nothing to compare it with, the patient's liver felt pretty hard, and since he was moaning, I concluded he had hepatitis. It broke my heart to blow our cover and call in a medevac. Our prey would undoubtedly fly the coop the minute the chopper blades whirred. But I wasn't going to let the guy die out there. While some of the men started cutting out an LZ, I took a piece of cardboard from a C-ration box and wrote a note to Raphael. "To Doc Benjamin, battalion surgeon, I am referring this patient to you because, in my opinion, he suffers from acute hepatitis. Please have a look at him. I will be interested to know what your conclusion is. Sincerely, David Hackworth, forward doctor." I gave the tag to the sick sergeant, and he was flown out. Sure enough, our elusive enemy disappeared entirely, and we came back to the firebase the next day empty-handed. That disappointment, however, was nothing compared to the news I got when I went to Raphael to check out my patient. "About that diagnosis," he said. "He had pneumonia. Good try." Deciding from that moment to give up medicine and concentrate on soldiering, I used the Tui Hua mission to think through our tactics and to try to find a way to fight the enemy without paying such a heavy price in casualties. For me, it was just a question of synthesizing all the ideas and input I'd received from my reading, notably Street Without Joy by the French on-the-ground scholar of the Indochina War, Bernard Fall, my mentors, especially the Special Forces guys I'd met at the career course, and my own growing experience. Colonel Rogers was open to suggestions, and we began to experiment in the battalion. It became virtually SOP to infiltrate company-size units into the bush during the night, for example. These units would form small company perimeters and radiate patrols out from there to comb the bush for unsuspecting enemy troops. We began practicing what the Australians preached and what Hank Emerson, the bold, forward-thinking gunfighter, had been doing successfully in the O2 since Lai K, finding the enemy not with unwieldy company-sized formations, but with small patrols fanning out in all directions of the battlefield, with backup elements available to reinforce, pile on, as Emerson would say, if a contact was made. Taking the risk and wearing the consequences of 7-man patrols possibly being gobbled up in the search. It was at night that the value of these decentralized, company-controlled operations became most clear. At the end of each day, these small teams became individual ambush patrols spread out all over the battle area. Besides regularly drawing blood, the nighttime patrols continuously allowed us to interdict the enemy's ingress-egress routes, in essence, to take the battlefield away from our foe. Again and again they proved what the raiders had proved in Korea, that small units with capable leaders can make a significant, even vital, contribution. Still, at first it was not easy to sell our young leaders on the new techniques, or even on the adoption of the Scouts Well Forward Australian way of moving through the bush, which reduced the risk of an entire unit getting wrapped around the axle. Right after Mi Khan, everyone was running scared, and while naturally they settled down, never again did I sense the "let's go get the bad guys" enthusiasm I had seen before that bloody fight. As Operation Gibraltar had for the 2502, 7 February woke everyone up in the 1327 to the reality of war. Slowly, the men began to understand a little more about their enemy and to respond in kind. Slowly, they began to develop patience, that VC strong point, that characteristic that gave the enemy the inner resources to collect, flatten, and tack together empty beer cans one onto the next and the next like shingles until he made a metal roof. "I think you better get back here soonest," Ben Willis said, calling me from the battalion's temporary base camp at Tui Hua. "Something's come up." He couldn't have sounded any more cryptic, and it was so unlike Ben that I took him at his word. Fortunately, things were quiet out in the field, and I could easily get away. So I grabbed Daryl, and as soon as we could, we hitched a chopper ride back to Tui Hua. Ben met us at the airstrip. "You'll never guess who's here," he said. "Miss Vin." "Who's Miss Vin?" "She said she knows you from Na Trang. Heard you were here and flew up by civilian aircraft." In one of the more bizarre aspects of the war, Air Vietnam, a commercial airline, operated virtually unimpeded throughout the fighting, taking off and landing on the same strips as our fighter aircraft, with few destinations off-limits, whatever was happening on the ground. We walked into the airline terminal, and there she was, looking absolutely beautiful with her long black hair and her sexy Ao Dai. I knew Miss Vin. She was the sister of the equally beautiful Vietnamese nurse I'd met when I was in the hospital at Na Trang, who'd taken it upon herself to look after me after I got out of the hospital but before I returned to my battalion. The nurse worked during the day, so it had been left to Miss Vin to provide half the tender loving care I received in the quiet little house she shared with her sister in the city. Though we had had no contact, no letters, no nothing in the 3 months since I'd left, she'd heard the 101st was in Tuy Hoa, and with the innocent faith that so many of the Vietnamese had, she figured if the 101st was there, I'd be there too, and we'd be able to get together. It had been a long, long time since I'd seen a woman. At least, it felt that way. I couldn't even think. "Where are we going to stay, Ben? I can't take her back to the battalion area. What about the city?" "You don't want to go there, man," Willis said. "It's all VC." But in the end, there wasn't any choice. VC or no VC, Tuy Hoa was the only place around. So we did a quick recon, found a hotel with an empty top floor, and while Willis and the girl organized the accommodation end of things, ever-resourceful Daryl started outfitting the room with camo equipment. Young, married, moral, poor Daryl. All the stuff he had to put up with from me. Still, after he finished setting up my PRC-25 radio and organizing a couple of extra batteries for it, so I could stay in constant contact with the battalion in the field and with Willis's rear CP, and Ben provided a box of hand grenades and plenty of ammo for my M16 and M79, at the same time promising to pull me out of a jam if necessary, the two of them left me and Miss Vin in peace. And for a couple of days of bliss overlooking the South China Sea, I gave instructions to the battalion staff as necessary through the radio, and Ben covered for me when Colonel Rogers asked where I was. It was not a bad way to fight a war. No sooner had I said goodbye to Miss Vin and made arrangements to go back to the field than General Pearson came looking for me. "Do you have people down with the Aussies?" he asked. "Right out," in such a way that it was kind of hard to evade, avoid, or change the subject. "I said. I did have people down with the Aussies, our third group, in fact. Graves, Dorland, and Godwin, the first group, had come back with a much better handle on the war, or so I felt. So I'd continued the program, was damn happy with it, and until Pearson confronted me, no one had been the wiser. Now, since I had to confess anyway, I asked General Pearson how he'd found out. It seemed that it was all due to Pat Graves, who, in his usual self-effacing and matter-of-fact way, had neglected to tell me that while with the Aussies he'd had occasion to take over the platoon he'd been observing when the Australian platoon leader was hit. Apparently, he'd performed most heroically, the result of which being the Australians sending a commendation for him to MacV, which had reportedly landed on the desk of none other than General Westmoreland, the man who'd vetoed the plan to send men to 1RAR in the first place. Pat Graves really was the best and the brightest. He was the ultimate West Point officer, a 6-feet-tall, straight-as-a-die romantic from Alabama who believed passionately in America and his fellow man. Firm in the conviction that we were embarked on a noble cause, Pat had volunteered from the 1st of the 506th Battalion at Campbell to join the 1st Brigade when word came we'd be going to Vietnam. Compassionate and dedicated, in the field he'd proved to be one of the best platoon leaders the 1st of the 327th had. Throughout his first tour, Pat kept a diary of his experiences, and he also wrote a piece called Observations of a Platoon Leader, with the hope that he could give the young officers who followed in his footsteps in Vietnam a head start, with pointers Pat would have liked to have known before he arrived. The piece was used at the Screaming Eagles replacement camp at Bien Hoa as well as by West Point's tactical department and the infantry school. Later, Pat would expand it into a 3-part series which would be published in Infantry Magazine and then Army-wide as a DA pamphlet. This was a real coup for a young lieutenant, and in the career stakes really put Pat above the rest. Even so, this fine platoon leader now had me in hot water. General Pearson really locked my heels together for disobeying Westy's original directive to Colonel Timothy, and I had no choice but to suspend the 1st of the 327th's Aussie connection for the rest of my tour. But while the whole thing then blew over, to me an irony remained. I was told Westy had deep-sixed the cross-training idea because it wouldn't have looked good from a public relations angle to have the Australians nursing the Screaming Eagles along. But from a public relations angle, what could have been more perfect than to have a 101 guy picking up the chips for the beleaguered Aussies? The people of Tuy Hoa successfully completed their rice harvest, and the 1st of the 101 turned its attention to the jungles and mountains in the surrounding area. The next 10 days or so were singularly uneventful, until the morning of 4 March, when I saw an old Viet gentleman walking toward the 1327th Battalion perimeter. Australian John Essex Clark always said that the Americans put too much stock in electronic intelligence gathering rather than feeling the pulse on the ground, so I told our S2, Lieutenant Jerry Nakashima, to go talk to the guy and see if he knew anything. The old man told Jerry he'd just seen men from the north wearing khaki and carrying long stovepipes moving toward the village of Tan Phu. The only reasonable interpretation of this was that a North Vietnamese unit carrying large mortars was setting up in a village to our southwest. But the question then was whether the old Viet was for real or a setup, a VC supporter, or perhaps just an innocent old man whose family was being held hostage by the NVA to lead us into a trap. In either case, this kind of volunteered information was a typical enemy ploy, and in assessing it, the only thing I had going for me was my instinct and the quaint way the Viet described what he'd seen to make me feel he was telling the truth. I gave Colonel Rogers the intelligence and the circumstances in which we got it. He swung A and B companies, which were just returning home from another operation, toward Tan Phu on separate axes, and by the time we'd organized our attack CPs, the colonel decided to tag along with the ABUs while I went with B Company. Bravo had already made contact just outside the village hamlet of Mi Phu. The subsequent fighting in and around Mi Phu was vicious. What seemed at first to be light fire from a squad-size enemy element within a short time became heavy automatic weapons fire from an enemy force of 2 to 3 companies. For a moment, it seemed we'd been lured in. The enemy was fighting from well-dug and fortified positions just as they had at Mi Khan. But all was not as it appeared. When I landed in the middle of B Company's fight, one of the first things I saw was an NVA company running around like headless chickens. We'd caught them on the move, a fact confirmed later in the day by a POW, who added that the NVA unit's intention had been to set up mortar positions to blast our firebase while hitting us with a 3-company ground attack. The old Viet man had been right. B Company was fully engaged, kicking ass, but also taking casualties. Even though they'd been surprised, the NVA's SOP went on the move to always have pre-dug defensive positions for just such a contingency, diminished our initial advantage. One of Bravo's medics took a slug in the back of his head. Raphael, who was on the ground treating the wounded the whole time, didn't think he'd make it, but felt it was worth a try. And together we dragged the medic along the ground in a poncho to a safer spot. Safer, in this fight, was relative. Across the battle area, you couldn't lift your head without drawing fire. I called for a medevac, and instantly a chopper was on the scene, its pilot asking for landing instructions. "Look, it's really hot down here," I told him. "You're going to have to volunteer for this one, 'cause you may not make it out." "Just tell me how to do it," he replied. I told him what I thought the best route would be, and the pilot followed my instructions to the letter. As the chopper landed, Raphael and I rushed the wounded medic to the open door. The chopper crew chief grabbed him and pulled him inside. Slugs were buzzing and snapping around the chopper like flies in a slaughterhouse as I turned to thank the pilot. Only then did I find this was no ordinary airplane driver, but Major Dave George, a dear old 8th Division friend of mine and rival from the Fort Benning Career Course days. We shook hands and started catching up on old times over the din of his helicopter, completely forgetting we were on the battlefield. It was probably the only reason neither of us got hit. "You've won me for life, stud," I told him as he prepared to carry the wounded away. It was the first of many medevac runs that good man and his brave crew would make to Mi Phu. Enemy dead were strewn all over the hamlet. Heiser and the men of Bravo had learned well at Mi Khan. At Mi Phu, they did not assault fixed positions. Instead, they hunkered down and let firepower dig the enemy out. Still, in the wake of their casualties and in the fog of battle, I wasn't sure who had the upper hand. All that changed when I saw one young black trooper firing like fury down a wide ditch with an M79. I raced over there to see that he'd killed some 30 NVA soldiers single-handedly. Such carnage on so small a section of the battlefield was a picture that said everything to me. Suddenly, I knew we had a solid victory on our hands. Meanwhile, A Company had taken 7 casualties in an attempt to come to our assistance and encircle the enemy forces. Over the radio, Colonel Rogers, who had gone airborne in his CNC to have a look at the whole fight, told me he thought we should break off. "No, sir," I said. "We've got to capitalize on this. We've got the enemy on the ropes. We're winning this one." "I agree with Hack," said General Pearson, who was monitoring our net from his bird above the battlefield. The two commanders then decided that because I was on the ground, I should take command of the engaged troops. It was another lucky break, but it was almost nipped in the bud when, a short time later, Raphael, Daryl, and I were leaning against the blown-out wall of a house and an enemy machine gun opened up right at us. How the gunner managed to stitch the wall between Daryl and me and move on to stitch between me and Raphael and not hit any of us was a miracle or a fluke beyond belief, but that was exactly what happened. Of course, we immediately shagged ass out of there. It wasn't a very cool place to be. The battle began to settle down to a slow, methodical, inch-by-inch finding of the enemy's dug-in positions and one by one destroying them. Just as dark was coming on, Abu's company commander, Hal Eaton, staggered into our position. It was very strange. He came out of nowhere, and he had to have walked from A Company straight through the NVA positions to get there. But we quickly found out how he'd done it. He was in shock, having taken grenade fragments in his throat. Only then did I get the full story on Abu's casualties. They were staggering. Not one officer of the 3 rifle platoons remained. All had been killed or wounded, with the greatest shock of all being the word that Harry the Horse Godwin was dead. At dark, the ABU weapons platoon, which was fighting as a rifle platoon and had been held as such in battalion reserve throughout the day, infiltrated the battle area and linked up with the remnants of its company. While Bob Press, ABU's first sergeant, who actually hit a mine the previous day but had chosen to stay with his unit when it was redirected toward Tan Phu, took command of the company, I radioed Harry the Horse's platoon. I spoke with Staff Sergeant Travis Martin, the only NCO left, and asked him if he thought he could run Harry's platoon for the night. "You bet, sir," the squad leader replied. "I've been training for a situation like this for 10 years. I directed A Company to get themselves squared away along the enemy's escape route to the south. Bravo, meanwhile, consolidated its positions along the escape route to the west. As both companies evacuated their casualties, I knew we desperately needed more men on the ground. With C Company off on a brigade mission, all I had as reserves were the Tigers, who'd spent the fight so far securing our fire base, a stupid damn job for them anyway. I decided to bring them in. "What about my security?" the artillery battery CO screamed through the radio when I gave him the word. "I need the infantry to secure me." "Well, you're not going to have them tonight," I replied. "Look at your TOE statement, young captain. It says you were capable of defending yourself, so let's see you do it." Denying the artillery its security was far less a concern to me than eliminating my reserve, but I was convinced we were soundly trouncing the enemy. What I wanted now was to get as many escape routes blocked as we could, then blow the hell out of the center of the NVA positions and catch the enemy troops with infantry ambushes as they scurried for safety. More and more, through my own experience and as it meshed with what I'd read of the French experience, as well as the views of the old Indochina hands and what Emerson was doing in the O2, I was concluding that this was the way to fight the NVA and the VC. The ammo was free. Only the taxpayer paid for that. And it made a lot more sense than trying to close with our hardcore opponent as we had at Mekong and suffer excessive casualties. The Tigers were inserted at 2100 hours in the brigade's first nighttime air mobile assault. They moved into their multiple ambush positions without casualties, despite being under fire from the moment they stepped out of the choppers at their One Bird LZ. Of the score of NVA stragglers killed throughout the night, the Tigers were responsible for about a dozen. Unfortunately, though predictably, many NVA escaped, too, through our far too open net, and bugged back to the hills. Come the early dawn, Daryl Nunley and I left B Company, where we'd spent the night, and moved out to the ABU's position. With us as well was the redoubtable Tom Hancock, who would replace the wounded Hal Eaton as A Company's commander. To appreciate how the tragic events of 4 March affected the men of ABU Company, it is necessary to understand the ABU spirit and the ABU history. The ABUs had actually evolved from another unit, the IBIS, also known as Item Company, 187th RCT. As the story went, in 1952, the companies of the 187th decided that rather than use standard military phonetics, that is, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, to identify themselves, they would give themselves names. Animals seemed to be the order of the day. L Company became Lion, M Company became Mighty Moose, and so on. But poor Item found the only animal that began with an I was a wading bird called an ibis, which just wouldn't do. It was Item Company's commander, Captain Robert Channon, who came up with the mythical IBU, in fact, an acronym for I is the best unit. All that was needed then was to decide what this never-before-seen creature looked like. Remarkably, the task was accomplished in a very short time. The IBU had a gorilla's body, a lion's head, a moose's horns, and an alligator's tail, and wore, for all eternity, a parachute and jump boots, and clutched a pistol in its right hand, and a knife, dripping blood, in its left. The IBU proliferated quickly, finding its way onto guidons, company signs, swagger sticks, an ivory IBU on one end, an ivory jump boot on the other, and the legs of many an IBU NCO in the form of a tattoo that stretched virtually from ankle to knee. When, in 1956, the 101st was reactivated and the 3rd Battalion 187th RCT, of which IBU was a part, was incorporated into the Pentomic 1st of the 327th Battle Group, instead of gracefully bowing out, the IBU, fierce figure of yesteryear, just changed its name, ABU, to accommodate its new company designation, A Company 1st of the 327th. For old-timers and newcomers alike, the legend of the IBU ABU was the glue that cemented the men of A Company together. At Fort Campbell, a good number of ABU's NCOs had been with the company since its early IBU days, even with rotation and normal attrition in Vietnam. On 4 March, many original ABUs, like 1st Sergeant Bob Press, who'd started out as a squad leader in 1956, remained. Unlike Bravo Company, which had had its baptism of fire in February, the fine cocky troopers of ABU had not seen a major battle in Vietnam before Mi Phu. Their losses, 13 KIA and almost 40 WIA, knocked the remaining members for one serious loop. The shock was only compounded by the death of indestructible Harry the Horse. If Harry died, the company's collective thought seemed to be, how could any of the poor mortals among them survive? The unit's morale had not just been damaged. It had been destroyed, or so it appeared when we arrived at their position, a rice paddy in the center of which were ABU's dead, neatly stacked row on row and covered with ponchos, on the outskirts of Mi Phu. I was quietly briefed on the events of the previous day. On Hal Eaton's order, ABU's 3rd platoon had assaulted across a dry rice paddy and taken 11 WIA in less than 50 yards, with 6 more lost when they'd attempted to advance over a dike on Mi Phu's perimeter. Harry Godwin's 2nd platoon had attacked across another open paddy, this one 75 yards long with absolutely no cover or concealment. The strength of the platoon had gone from 35 to 8 men before they were halfway across, with the weapon squad suffering 100% casualties. Among the KIA were Harry the Horse, who'd led the attack, and his RTO, Reuben's sweet daddy Grace Garnett. The story went that Harry fell first, and when Sweet Daddy automatically went to his aid, he was dropped by the same gun that had killed his friend. Sweet Daddy was holding Harry's hand when he died. So far from home, the bond of love and friendship these two men shared in life and death transcended the separate worlds they'd known in America. Harry Godwin was a dyed-in-the-wool Southerner, and Reuben Garnett, a black man born and raised in the ghettos of Philadelphia. The ABU survivors sat dazed and defeated, hunkered down behind rice paddy walls. I knew I had to get them back on their horses immediately or they'd never ride again. "So you guys have taken your lumps," I began, and proceeded to remind them of who they were, the ABUs, the best, and what ABU, the 1st of the 327th and the U.S. Army paratrooper, was all about. Then I tore their collective ass for violating the basics, which had led to all their problems in the first place. 1st Sergeant Press later told me the whole speech had been good news, especially to the older NCOs, who'd been trying to get their platoons to act and react tactically as they'd been trained, rather than taking on all the bad habits sanctioned by the most recent company commander who'd brought his gung-ho, ultra-aggressive bad habits from his last unit, the Airborne All the Way 173rd. I must have begun my speech squatted down near the troopers and then stood up and started walking around, because suddenly a sergeant called out, "Get down, sir, there's a machine gun in that house," referring to the substantial stone structure in the village behind us. "Fuck a lot of machine guns," I replied, and marched over to the paddy wall beyond which stood the house. I turned to the men. "Who's going with me?" I asked, and hopped over the wall. I started moving toward the house, using paddy walls as a concealed and covered approach. I was damn scared. I didn't want to go like Jim Gardner. But since I'd gone through the village with Daryl and Hancock on my way to ABU's position and hadn't seen a single live enemy, I figured the odds had to be on my side. Besides, the exercise was worth it if only to set an example and make the ABUs grab hold of their bootstraps and pull themselves up. Some, mostly NCOs, were already doing so. About a dozen had followed me over the first paddy wall. When I got to the side of the house, I threw a grenade through the window, then jumped up and hosed down the dead crew inside. Then I formed a skirmish line of the troopers who joined me for a sweep through the village. I was end man, moving along a paddy wall. We hadn't gone very far when I saw a sudden movement on my right. Out of a spider hole popped an NVA soldier holding a rifle in one hand, a grenade in the other. The guy was about to throw the grenade in front of the skirmish line. I could see there was no way I'd be able to spin my rifle around fast enough to stop him, so I just dropped my weapon and tackled the guy. I threw his grenade away and dragged him out of his hole. He was wounded, probably in the previous day's fight, and I turned him over to press with instructions to get a chopper to evacuate him to Brigade HQ and made damn sure no one killed him in the meantime. The ABU boys weren't butchers, but after what they'd been through, the passion for revenge would naturally be high. Hancock and I personally counted 118 dead NVA troops on the ground at Mi Fu before I left him to his new command. He was a good choice as skipper, as competent an officer as he was a scrounger, and the ideal guy to charge the ABUs, having been A Company's XO both at Fort Campbell and in the early Vietnam days. Unfortunately for all concerned, however, Hancock was not so lucky on the battlefield. Less than 24 hours after he took command of the ABUs, he was evacuated to the States, his hand badly wounded in the mortar attack on our firebase that the 95th NVA, our opponents at Mi Fu, as they'd been at Mi Con, went ahead with, just as one of the POWs had outlined, despite the beating we'd given them the day before. So Hancock was gone. Captain Wayne Dill, a replacement from the 82nd, and a brave, solid soldier who was not afraid to tell the boss what he thought, became the ABU's new old man. No sooner had I left the ABU's than I received a radio message to return to brigade immediately. I got in a chopper and headed for Tuy Hoa, where I was met by General Pearson in his clean, starched fatigues. I, on the other hand, was filthy from head to toe, with a two-day scruffy beard to boot. "General Westmoreland would like you to brief him on yesterday's battle," Pearson said. "Shouldn't I change clothes or shave, sir?" "Nope, you're perfect. You look just great." Pearson escorted me to the briefing tent, and I told Westy about the fight. I did feel we'd acquitted ourselves well, though the casualties we'd suffered were still far, far too high for the result. Though we'd caught the enemy on the move, he'd been able to take advantage of his already established dug-in positions, and by not specifically restraining ABU, Colonel Rogers and I allowed them to attack right into the buzzsaw with typical airborne aggressiveness. But naturally I did not tell any of this to General Westmoreland. He got just the highlights. When I'd finished, he said, "You've done a good job, and you're to be congratulated. It sounds as if you've pretty well mauled the VC battalion. Now they're groggy, and you've got to keep after them, which I presume is your plan." "Yes, sir," I replied. The briefing over, I headed for the door, only to be stopped by a final congratulations from the theater commander. "Well done, Major," he said, and then added, "Now you've just got to pursue, pursue, pursue." "Yes, sir," I said. Pursue, I thought, as I walked out of the tent. Did he really mean he wanted us to charge into the woods and get our asses torn apart by the enemy's inevitable delaying screen of snipers and booby traps? In World War II, there were numerous cases of one sniper stopping a rifle battalion for hours, killing and wounding dozens of soldiers in the process. Did Westy really want us to make that investment in lives here in Vietnam for so little return? Surely not. This was not the same kind of war as World War II. This was not a war of terrain objectives, a fact I'd come to appreciate the hard way at Mi Con, each one worth the price of lives if in taking it you moved closer to your final objective, your Berlin, your Tokyo, or Pyongyang. Vietnam was a war where more often than not our elusive enemy just went to ground or ran away while we swept through and cleared a village, only to return, rebuild, and reoccupy it again the minute we'd moved on. Mi Fu was a classic example. 21 of our men were dead in a battle for a piece of real estate that elements of the battalion, even A Company itself, had searched a number of times in the weeks previous to the 4 March fight. And unlike World War II, where, in just one example, 10,000 U.S. Marines were stacked up on the beaches of Saipan in 4 hours because we needed that island to construct an airbase to bomb Japan to end the war, in Vietnam, at Mi Fu, 21 of our men were dead in a battle for a piece of real estate that had no strategic or tactical value, and that would be abandoned by our pursuing forces as soon as the dust settled. I left Mi Fu feeling as I had after Mi Con. There must be a better, less expensive way to fight these sons of bitches. The whole Tui Hua experience led to a big jump in my tactical thinking. I recognized my error at Mi Kan. I'd fought the battle by automatic reflex based on my previous combat experience, and with everything happening so fast, it hadn't occurred to me that my second nature reactions might be wrong. I'd fought the battle as I would have done in Korea. Hal Moore had fought Ya Drang like Korea too, but in his case, it had been a Korea-style battle. The NVA attacked the Cav in waves, not unlike the Chinese had attacked us in the winter of 50 and the spring of 51. In my case, I'd had a mission to relieve a besieged unit. I'd deployed my men with one element blocking in case the enemy broke and ran, which is what he was supposed to do. The other's job, to roll up the enemy's flank, was a sound employment of forces for a set-piece battle, except that Mi Kan had not been a set-piece battle. The enemy's disposition had not been well-defined. He'd had no flanks, per se, and his discreet unorthodox, in terms of the U.S. style of fighting, brilliantly concealed and fortified positions had not exactly been conducive to being rolled up. My brain had automatically told me that to relieve Murphy's unit, I'd have to take the village where the men were besieged. I'd fought for a terrain objective, which the student of guerrilla warfare in me knew was not the way to fight this war, but which the Korea-seasoned warrior in me did not have time or take time to remember. Drawing on the Mi Kan experience and the subsequent week's fighting that culminated at Mi Fu, as the Tui Hua mission drew to a close, I began to advocate more and more small-size patrols for the battalion and more night operations to steal the darkness from the enemy, who up until now had moved freely through it. Though Emerson would be the first to conduct a full-scale battalion-sized nighttime air mobile assault, never again would I let the night hamper me as it had at Mi Kan, again a result of my Korea experience, which demanded with the coming of darkness that a unit consolidate, dig in, and get set to be hit. I realized, too, that the presence of a large enemy element should not be the green light for a full-scale assault by our men. After all, what had caused the carnage at Tui Hua were the heroic airborne charges. Tui Hua proved to me once and for all that the paratroopers were innately unfit for guerrilla warfare, even Phase 2 battalion and regiment-size guerrilla warfare. So were Marines, of whom Harry the Horse had been one before he joined the 101st. Both types of warriors were trained for shock action, to violently close with the enemy and destroy him, and then go back to a rear area to marshal, refit, train, and wait for the next mission. Both were eager, motivated, and aggressive, all admirable characteristics in a conventional war. But on a guerrilla battlefield, they became too eager, too motivated, too aggressive. Both airborne and Marines were determined, but they had no patience. They were always long on guts, but sometimes short on brains. After Tui Hua, I also realized that my attitude toward decentralized command and mission-type orders notwithstanding, there were times when the issuance of more exacting instructions to my paratroop units was absolutely essential to get the job done right, with the minimum of casualties. But the main thing I learned at Tui Hua was that there was simply no point in taking an objective you had no intention of holding, no point in using men when firepower could do the job. Tui Hua's battlefields may have looked like the hedgerows of Normandy, but if, as was the case, the taking of such objectives one by one wasn't ultimately going to lead you any place, and if, as was also the case, you were going to abandon each objective after you'd taken it, only to take it again and abandon it again, again and again and again, as the French did before us and as we were doing now, well, it wasn't worth the life of even a single soldier. I'd learned. Just after Mi Fu, Colonel Rogers finished his 6-month command tour with the 1st of the 327th. In and out like clockwork, battalion commanders had 6 months, company commanders had 3, just long enough to figure out what they didn't know. Rogers' replacement, Lieutenant Colonel Walter Meinzen, had been away from troops for a long time. Fortunately, I was to stay on as the 1st of the 327th's XO to provide continuity in the battalion. Not long after this change of command, word came from Nha Trang that Gentleman John Howard, who was hospitalized there with malaria, was to be evacuated to the States. This came as a hell of a blow, to me because I loved the guy, and to the battalion because he was just such a damn fine officer. Though I'd once put him on ice in the S3 shop to keep him alive, after Jim Gardner was killed, I'd sent him to the Tigers. He'd wanted more action, and the unit had needed him. Since I had a few logistic things to take care of in Nha Trang anyway, Raphael and I decided to use the trip as a little R&R and visit Johnny in the hospital. Apparently our young friend was one sick hombre, but in Raphael's expert opinion he looked pretty good when we arrived, so we persuaded Dr. Barton Black Bart Pakul, a friend of Raphael's and one of the hospital doctors, to let us take Johnny out for a temporary holiday, just to sit in the sun at the beach and enjoy himself. Black Bart wasn't exactly convinced when we promised that his patient wouldn't drink or eat the wrong foods and that we'd have him back in his hospital bed by 1800 hours, but because Raphael was a doctor, and a damn good one at that, he gave us the nod. We really did mean to keep our word. It was just that we kind of got sidetracked when we hit the first of the Nha Trang clubs. By 1800, we were drunk enough to forget to take Johnny back to the hospital, and instead stumbled over to the La Frigate, an open-air restaurant that Johnny promptly, and at the top of his lungs, renamed Rick's American Cafe. We drank and ate the richest food on the menu, and despite the fact that Johnny grew greener by the second, good trooper that he was, he still got up on a table in the middle of the club and began his Rudyard Kipling recitation. A few less than romantic souls kept interrupting him until we threatened to clunk their heads together. Johnny soldiered on, orating eloquently as he swayed from sickness and booze until he got knocked in the head by a whirling ceiling fan and fell off the table. I think that's when we decided to take him back. Black Bart was in a rage when we dragged his patient back to his hospital bed. Besides the fact that we hadn't kept our end of the bargain, we'd unknowingly triggered such a relapse in Johnny's condition that for the next couple of days the docs thought he was going to die. He didn't, thank God, but then they contemplated court-martialing him for abusing his government-leased body. Fortunately, that didn't come to pass either, and he was soon sent home where he fully recovered. Johnny would return to Vietnam to distinguish himself at the 1972 Battle of An Lok, and subsequently go on to become a boy general. A few days later, my other Tiger platoon leader, Dennis Foley, got a Nha Trang R&R of his own, thanks to the battalion's policy that a wounded trooper, wherever he was, had to be paid on payday just like his buddies, and he had to be paid by one of his own officers. This SOP was good not just for the soldiers' morale, but also for the officers. An unwritten rule was that after the hospital visit, the rest of the day, and the night, was his. Foley planned to take full advantage of it. He'd gone to Nha Trang almost directly from the field, unshaved and unwashed in his distinctive Tiger Force fatigues. After he'd paid the troops, he planned to clean himself up and head over to Marie Kim's, a favorite Screaming Eagle's watering hole for falling in love. As he headed up the street from the hospital, an OD Army sedan with two stars on the bumper standard pulled up beside him. General Larson, the IFFV commander, opened the door and stuck his head out. "What are you doing in town, Lieutenant?" "I came to pay the troops," Dennis replied. "Got a place to stay tonight?" the general asked. "Not yet, sir." "Well, hop in." Dennis didn't have much choice. He got into the sedan and they drove off. Larson, who loved the 101st, had recognized Foley's Tiger fatigues and took the chance encounter to get a first-hand report on how we were doing. The two men chatted in the car, and before long they'd arrived at Larson's quarters, a stately old French villa. A valet showed Foley to his bedroom for the night and pointed out the bathroom. The valet brought him a drink and Dennis took a shower, but by the time he got back to the bedroom, all his clothes were gone. In their place was a set of General Larson's fatigues, complete with stars embroidered on the jacket. "Put these on," said the valet. "We're washing yours." Again, Dennis didn't have much choice, and before long the second lieutenant in the Major General's gear was having cocktails with the genuine item in the dining room of this villa. Drinks led to dinner. Dinner led to coffee. Coffee led to adjournment into another room for cognac and cigars, and war stories flowed throughout. It was an extraordinary event. But for Dennis, the experience was double-edged. Few lieutenants would ever dream they'd spend a pleasant evening at home with their commanding general. But on the other side of things, Dennis had been dreaming of getting laid. ever since he'd left Tui Hua, and the general just wouldn't let him go. Larson was like a lonely prisoner in his own headquarters. He was a corps commander who had no corps to fight, a major general without a Berlin or Tokyo to capture, a superb field soldier, battle-tested in almost 4 tough years of Pacific fighting in World War II and another year's combat in Korea, stuck in the ultimate nothing-to-do job. The long Nha Trang day turned into night, and Dennis knew he'd lost, if not his chance, then at least his options at Marie Kim's. He finally excused himself by saying he had to get some sleep. He had an early plane to catch. "I'll have my driver take you over to the airport," Larson volunteered, and any hope Dennis had had of grabbing a morning quickie evaporated in an instant. Foley went back to his bedroom to find his tiger uniform newly washed, pressed, and starched, and his boots polished. Just as he began undressing for the night, one of Larson's aides appeared at the door of the room. "The general has retired for the evening," he said. "He asked me to pass on to you that if there's any place you need to go, or anything you want to do before you retire, please feel free to do so. You'll find a driver and a car outside, and one of us will be here to let you in whenever you return." Swede Larson may have been a hell of a general, but he was also a soldier's soldier. The 1st Brigade received a well-earned Valorous Unit citation for the Tui Hua operations, and the 1st of the 327th got a separate one for Mi Fu. VUCs weren't easy to come by, so both brigade and battalion were damn proud. For my guys in the 1st of the 327th, though, the experience at Tui Hua had meant a lot more. The soldiers had begun to get hard there, not just physically, but upstairs, where it really counted. After 8 months in Vietnam, they'd dealt death and seen death in numbers none could have imagined. They'd endured leeches and jungle rot, constant heavy rains and clammy clothes that chilled them in their sleep, and the wait-a-minute bushes that could hold a trooper as tenaciously as a strand of barbed wire. Many fought malaria and hepatitis, all fought fear, not just of the enemy, but of the snakes, the tigers of the Central Highlands that reportedly pounced on troopers, the monkeys that dropped out of trees at night like stealthy Viet Cong. At least one of these was hacked to death by a trooper with a machete in the dark. And, of course, the night itself. But through it all, they'd learned, and little by little exchanged bravado for real confidence. Everyone did. If they stayed long enough, even the pilots like Outlaw 5-3 who'd insisted on having his chopper blasted out of the sky at Mi Con. I met him again 4 months later, at a big party we threw in celebration of the battalion's brilliantly fought end-of-tour graduation exercise, the Battle of Dak To. When Outlaw 5-3 heard one of my guys call me Savoy Volley 5, he came over to introduce himself and tell me that as a result of our last encounter, he'd left his know-it-all God's gift to aviation days behind. That same evening, a lot of other pilots came up and introduced themselves as White Eagle 4 or Splendid Horse 2 or whatever their call signs were, and mentioned the operations where we'd served together. It wasn't too often that guys on the ground met the men who supported them and vice versa. We were all generally just voices on the radio, so there was an immediate camaraderie among us. And there was a lot of mutual respect, too. We looked in awe at the pilots for some of the amazing risks they took in our support, particularly to evacuate wounded soldiers on the ground. The pilots treated us infantry guys as if we were Wyatt Earp gunfighters in the old Tombstone Bar, the ones who dished it out and had to take it the hard way. In a high-tech world, the pilots somehow made their helicopters a romantic symbol of a bygone era. They rode those choppers as they would have done their horses in the old cav or cowboy days, coming in guns a-blazing, swooping down over the battlefield to save the day with their tremendous mobility and firepower. Unfortunately, the feeling of power most chopper drivers felt could work both for the infantry and against us. Over-enthusiastic pilots sometimes got a little carried away, firing first and only then ascertaining whether the target was friend or foe. This developed in the infantry a definite ambivalence toward the flyers and their gallant steeds, but like a lot of relationships, love, hate, or other, if it were all weighed up, we wouldn't have dreamed of letting them go. While the Screaming Eagle Fire Brigade moved to the coastal town of Phan Thiet to prepare to do battle in what intelligence reports indicated was a large Viet Cong stronghold somewhere along the nearby Vietnamese 2 and 3 Corps boundary, I prepared to go on R&R. "Raphael," I said to Doc Benjamin, who was going as well, "organize us a kit, a pill for every possible contingency. If we get malaria, we've got to cure it for 5 days. Hepatitis, cure it for 5 days. The runs, VD, anything. I don't want to miss one stroke on this R&R. We arrived in Hong Kong, and each of us got a suite at the Hilton. In mine, I filled the tub with hot water and bubble bath, rang room service, and ordered champagne, hors d'oeuvres, and a tailor. Neither Raphael nor I had any civilian gear. In Hong Kong, everything was beautifully and instantly made to order, and cheap as hell. So we spent our first wad of dough on clothes, in duplicate, triplicate, or by the dozen. Then Raphael wanted to go out and buy some stuff for his wife, and I decided that whatever he got for Karen, I'd get for Patty. We bought mink stoles and diamond rings. It didn't hurt that the night before we left Vietnam, I'd gotten into a poker game at the Nha Trang Officers Club, and in the course of the evening won almost a 5-figure bundle of free money to round out my Hong Kong kit bag. Beaded sweaters and beaded purses, and finished off the spree by buying ourselves each a gold Rolex watch. At that time, a mere couple of months' pay. We probably spent $6,000 each the very first day. But what the hell? We were there, we were having fun, and we were alive. What else mattered? Upon returning to the brigade base camp at Phan Rang, I was informed I was to report to brigade forward at Phan Thiet soonest. Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Garten, CO of the 2nd of the 327th, had been badly wounded when a VC mine blew his jeep to hell and back. He'd taken a bad hit in the leg and shrapnel in the head. It was a terrible waste of a World War II DSC winner, bearer of a perfect attendance 3-war CIB, and all-round brilliant soldier. A hell of a combat commander, Garten had breathed fire into the previously sluggish 2nd-to-none 2nd of the 327th, renaming it the No Slack Battalion, and cutting no slack until the unit shaped up. It was just beginning to come into its own as a great-spirited outfit when Garten was hit, so his loss was felt the whole way down the chain of command. Fortunately, Lieutenant Colonel Joe Wasco, the Brigade XO, and another fine, long-time airborne man had been sent up to the 2nd of the 327th to take Garten's place and keep up his good work. The reason I had to report to Phan Thiet soonest was that I was to replace Colonel Wasco. The Brigade XO was the third most senior person in the brigade, right behind General Pearson and his deputy, Colonel Ted Metaxas. The position generally went to a senior lieutenant colonel, of which there were a number in the 101st, and I was only a major. General Pearson's decision immediately put me in a very difficult position. Just as in the vanguards, where Colonel Newbreed had catapulted me over his senior majors and Colonel Sniffen to become his deputy for the ATT, now I was in charge of a staff where almost everyone outranked me. Army officers being a breed keenly aware of such things as date of rank and the attendant pecking order, there was a lot of resentment among the staff. This was only compounded by the fact that their new boss was the one they'd sniped at and bitched about continually during the octopus days, the one who refused to play their paper-pushing game at the battalion level. Still, to me the irony of it all was wonderful, and even I was surprised at how diplomatic I was in my initial letter of instruction to these no-good pricks who were suddenly showering me with love and affection. Some of you, I know from experience, do everything you can to help the units. Some of us have the attitude that the units are here to make our job easier. Our responsibility is to do everything possible to help the battalions and the individual companies. No one on the staff will say no to a subordinate unit. Only the general will say no. The friction eased pretty quickly, or maybe I just stopped noticing it. General Pearson was a damned efficient paper man, and from day one, I was too busy burning the midnight oil to stay ahead of the old man to get involved in staff politics. Pearson was a high-intellect kind of guy, more a staff man than a commander. He drove his people hard, a result perhaps of his own iron self-discipline. He'd taken a memory course, and henceforth never forgot a thing. He could fall asleep in an instant and wake up fully restored 10 minutes later. He was a no-nonsense man who hurried his briefers along with a Next point, that cracked like an M1 rifle. He was ruthless in a quiet way, but a strong supporter of those who served him well. Though he lacked the John's type of showmanship that electrified the troops, Pearson was a knowledgeable and fair man, and the perfect general for the war in Vietnam, which was a battalion, not a brigade commander's war. An exception to this was when a brigade commander was a romping, stomping warrior type with a real feel for on-the-ground battle. Then the war could be a brigade CO's war, but Pearson generally stood back from the action. He ran his unit more like a division than a brigade, but in the first of the 101st, this suited his romping, stomping warrior-type battalion subordinates just fine. The way it really shook out was that O2 Commander Hank Emerson was the tactical brains of the brigade, and I was his assistant. We were both innovators who bounced ideas off each other. The quality of these ideas was often propelled by the competitive spirit we shared, a clean and comfortable competition based on abiding mutual respect. We'd sell them to Pearson, and if an idea really worked, the general would implement it across the board in the brigade. Somehow this created a great rapport among us. Hank and I, the sometimes crude, always maverick warriors, Pearson, a man with the dedication and spirit of a modern-day Cromwell, as straight as they come, yet able to look the other way when necessary, as he had when he'd seen the millions of tents in the first of the 327th Battalion area, or when he found out about my unauthorized Australian connection.